If you and I have the courage to tell our elected officials that we want our national policy based on what we know in our hearts is morally right, we cannot buy our security, our freedom from the threat of the bomb, by committing an immorality so great as saying to a billion human beings now enslaved behind the Iron Curtain, give up your dreams of freedom, because to save our own skins, we're willing to make a deal with your slave masters. Alexander Hamilton said, a nation which can prefer disgrace to danger is prepared for a master and deserves one. Now let's set the record straight. There's no argument over the choice between peace and war, but there's only one guaranteed way you can have peace, and you can have it in the next second. Surrender. Admittedly, there's a risk in any course we follow other than this, but every lesson of history tells us that the greater risk lies in appeasement. And this is the specter our well-meaning liberal friends refuse to face, that their policy of accommodation is appeasement. And it gives no choice between peace and war, only between fight or surrender. If we continue to accommodate, continue to back and retreat, eventually we have to face the final demand, the ultimatum. And what then? Well, Nikita Khrushchev has told his people he knows what our answer will be. He has told them that we're retreating under the pressure of the Cold War, and someday, when the time comes to deliver the final ultimatum, our surrender will be voluntary, because by that time, we will have been weakened from within spiritually, morally, and economically. He believes this because from our side, he's heard voices pleading for peace at any price, or better rev than death, or as one commentator put it, he'd rather live on his knees than die on his feet. And therein lies the road to war, because those voices don't speak for the rest of us. You and I know and do not believe that life is so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. If nothing in life is worth dying for, when did this begin? Just in the face of this enemy? Or should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the pharaohs? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world? The martyrs of history were not fools. And our honored dead, who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis, didn't die in vain. Where then is the road to peace? Well, it's a simple answer after all. You and I have the courage to say to our enemies, there is a price we will not pay, there is a point beyond which they must not advance.
Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. Co-hosting for this episode is a frequent guest of the show, Nick Betts, as a Army veteran. Nick, what's going on, brother?
Not much, man. How you doing?
I'm good, man. I am good. So for this episode, I had an interview with a former British paratrooper by the name of Stu Pearson. And Stu, he stepped on a landmine in 2006 in southern Afghanistan. And we had a full discussion about it, and we went into details. There was a movie made about it. In the States, the title of the movie, you can find it on Netflix, is Kilo 2 Bravo. And it basically goes in like chronological order from... What they were doing essentially was protecting a dam. It was called the Kajaki Dam, and it was providing a lot of the power for Helmand Province. So that was something that the Taliban placed a priority on trying to disrupt from continuing. So they sent in three para to defend this dam. And from what I understand, they were pretty successful at it. And... basically, what happened was they had a sniper embedded with them, and they noticed enemy activity, but they were too far away to take shots at. So what they decided to do was send a small team out up into a high point so they can get a little closer and take some shots at these guys. And en route to where they had determined would be a good position to set up, they ended up walking through a minefield. And I think it was a total of six guys were injured, and one British paratrooper was killed. And ultimately, they were stuck in this minefield for, I think, over 4 hours. And an American pararescue unit ended up coming in and getting them out. So it's an interesting movie. It's a pretty compelling story. And Stu is a pretty inspirational guy. So we'll play that for you guys a little bit later on. But for right now, we have on David Pavlik, and David is a Army Special Forces Green Beret veteran who owns a business. And Dave, how's it going?
Hey, John, how's it going? What's up, Nick?
What's up, man? So, Dave, you tell us a little bit of your background, coming from probably enlistment. If you kind of went in with an 18 X-ray contract, or if you spent some time in one of the shittier units before going off to selection.
I enlisted specifically to be SF, part of the 18 X-ray program, and like I was telling John a little while ago. A lot of folks are like, oh, you don't really come off as being the typical X-ray, the X-ray that everyone thinks of, which is kind of like the immature 19-year-old really fit kid that's kind of given the 18 X-rays a bad name. And that was just kind of because I did 4 years at a military college, and I just declined my commission. I enlisted because the 18 X-ray program just kind of opened up post 9/11. And SF was all I wanted to do. It was something that kind of came up. I don't even know if I was going to do the military probably halfway through military school, just because I'd kind of gone, I don't know, maybe I'll do JAG, or maybe I'll be a lawyer. I don't know. And 9/11 happened, and the main guys on the ground that were affecting change were these bearded SF guys and some guys from the agency special activity staff. So those were the guys I wanted to be. So that kind of spurred me into enlisting.
Now, what was your MOS when you were in? Obviously, it was an 18 series, but what was your field specialty?
I was an 18 Charlie. That's engineer sergeant, special forces engineer sergeant. And we like to joke, we're kind of like 18 Bravos, but we can do math. So our main focus was demolitions. You know, we have a civil engineer capacity, which I'd say is utilized a lot less, certainly during combat rotations. I like to say I did more destruction than construction. But
yeah, you don't seem like the kind of guy to jump in and want to build a bridge for, you know, a bunch of locals.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, you're talking about Kajaki. That same trip when they were actually building the Kajaki Dam, I had another mission, and that's one of the things we did was we had to kind of oversee this project building a bridge across the Helmand River. It was this multi-million dollar project, and we got to do it, and this general flew in, and during his speech to a bunch of Afghans, which was getting translated in Dari and Pashto, he goes, just goes to show you, the SF guys, they don't just fly in and kill everybody. They can build bridges too. And we were sitting there like, did this guy is a 3-star general? Did he just say that? So yeah, we build bridges too, apparently.
So Dave, with your 18 Charlie background and being mathematically inclined, did that help you quite a bit once you went to cyber school?
I did. I was lucky enough to go to sniper school after Todd Hodnett had kind of a really big influence on special operations, long range shooting. And so, you know, there is math involved. We were using Horus back then, and ATRAG, and, you know, the birth of applied ballistics. And so a lot of that is math. A lot of that is cowboy math, as Todd likes to say. So, some of it, actually, there were like quick win formulas and little things you could memorize. And then, I mean, so Nick, you were shooting a long time, with scouts. I mean, when I deployed, one of my first deployments to Afghan, and then my second deployment to Afghanistan, I carried a sniper rifle and I wasn't even sniper qualified yet. I just kind of trained the teams and whatever. And what really helped me with some of the intangibles, like calculating wind, was just experience. I mean, math can get you to your ballistic solution, but, you know, things like wind blowing, wind going two or three different directions across, you know, 1,200 meters, 1,500 meters across the valley, that's stuff that I learned to just kind of start to feel. And
always something that I took a lot of joy in as well when, you know, going through the different schools, whether it was the Army Sniper School or when I was contracting and kind of had to go through their program. I always took way more joy out of being spot on with calling wind as opposed to being spot on with pulling the trigger, because the wind is the more difficult variable. The gun's going to do the same shit every time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I kind of became obsessive in Afghanistan. I would just spend hours and hours, and you know, as much as I do that, it's not in the shooting, it's in the waiting, and, you know, forcing myself to learn patience was something that served me a lot better as a sniper than, you know, sitting there and really crunching the numbers and calculations. And then, and spotting wind using Mirage, that was really the way I learned how to spot wind. So when I did a sniper course at Fort Bragg and there were trees and grass and taller grass and bushes, I was like, this is awesome, man. I can see everything.
Right.
Before I was just, you know, looking at weird distortions in the air. So.
Yeah, we've been super fortunate to have, and I say we as in shooters, and I guess the industry as a whole, to have Todd kind of come in and bring his knowledge and pretty much kind of revolutionize the way that classes are being ran. And, you know, with his hands in on the special operations and even just the military community and kind of rewriting the book, we went from, you know, the old school Carlos Hathcock days and, you know, kind of podunk M14s to, you know, the stuff that Todd is doing now with Horus, and it's drastically helping out all the shooters out there and, you know, making dead people more dead.
And Todd likes to push the envelope, and I really like that. And Todd doesn't care about a lot of the, I guess a lot of the old school mentality and some of those rules, like twists. You know, Todd and I 3 or 4 years ago were talking about twists, and we were talking about going faster and, you know, progressive gain twists and things like that. And I was like, hey man, what about, you know, a progressive gain twist where it starts at 1.75 and then it goes to, you know, 1.8, 1.9 over, you know, a shorter barrel. And he's like, well, how short? I'm like, 16 inches. I want to make this 308, you know, planning out the AD-17 back then. And he's like, I mean, honestly, if you're going to start fast, you might as well stay fast, especially if it's going to be that short. And, you know, a year or two later, I spotted him again, a shot. And he was like, yeah, man, I've gone that fast. I shot it and I was shooting, you know, a 12.5 inch 308 barrel out to a mile. And that was stuff that, you know, 5, 10 years ago, we'd say is completely impossible. Can't be done. It's just, there's no way in hell. And it's the same thing. It's something I learned that was just, there's conventional thinking, and then there's what really happens, and math doesn't lie and the bullet doesn't lie. And we're finding out more and more, you know, one thing conflict kind of helps with is innovation. And he's kind of innovated how we look at physics. So I really respect Todd, and I admire him, and I'm glad to call him my friend.
And that caveats really well into kind of what you're doing now. So how many rotations did you do overseas?
I deployed 6 times. Two of those were in Afghanistan. One of them was in Iraq. And then I did a couple trips to South and Central America.
So at what point in time during your career, or maybe it was post-career, did you kind of realize you wanted to create a firearms manufacturing company?
So, it's kind of funny how that goes. Again, I told you we were like bravos with math. I was doing more like a bravo in a lot of ways, because I loved tinkering with the guns. I'd gone to the Infantry Mortar Leaders Corps, so I would run mortars on the team. I messed with all the sniper systems. I was one of the first guys messing around with the Mark 13 back then. And then I was kind of this. I was always wanting to try out something new. What if we did free float rails? What if we didn't do this kind of rail? What if we did you know, this charging handle? What about ambidextrous charging handles? What about this kind of selector switch? And so we would try those out on the team and kind of tweak our weapons, augment our weapons a little bit there. And then it kind of turned into buddies of mine from the unit, buddies of mine from other units would bring me their personally owned guns and go, hey man, what can we do to this? And we take it a couple steps further. And so, towards the end of my SF career, as a side project, we kind of, I had $2,000 in my pocket. We made a, giant oven, like an 8-foot by 4-foot oven to do Cerakote, because Cerakote was something that I had gotten a chance to test out in combat, a couple times. And I thought it was great. And so we started Cerakoting guns, and then we went from Cerakoting guns to changing out the rails, to changing out barrels, muzzle devices, to the point where we came to everything but the lower receiver. We basically, someone would give us this gun, like some Rock River or something, and we would replace everything but the lower receiver and recode it and do everything else. And it worked better, to the point where we went, man, why are we polishing this thing? Why don't we just make our own and make everything we wanted it to be, in an upper and a lower and a rail system. And that's kind of what it morphed into. We went and got an FFL and started manufacturing and kind of jumped into it. And then, you know, all the good things that are part of this industry we experience, and a lot of the bad things too. You know, there are all kinds of pitfalls to starting your own business, and you know that as well as I do. And so it's been an interesting and bumpy road, but I'm glad I started it.
Yeah, and that's what's kind of so sad about the industry, quote unquote, if you know that's what we want to call it, is something that I've noticed from early on, pretty much my first introduction to it with AmericanSnipers.org, is I just quickly realized how cutthroat it is and how quick everybody is to backstab everybody. And you would think in a community that boasts about staying strong and supporting one another and supporting veteran businesses, that's honestly pretty much not the case. And you're hard pressed to find mutual competing companies that are pleasurable to each other and nice. So, and you know, I thankfully, as of right now, I haven't seen any of that, but I know that you've kind of experienced that already in the past.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, some of it comes from within, and that's the stuff that really hurts. And then some of it is, a lot of it is external, and it comes from, some of them come from massive companies, some of them come from smaller companies, some of them come from companies that you wouldn't even think are really competing with you, but they'll kind of take advantage, especially if you're a newer company starting up. I mean, I remember my first SHOT Show. We were debuting the Reaper 33 edition of our rifle, and I was talking to the CEO of a I'll just say a major company in the Northwest that sells parts and now sells rifles. And we were having a conversation. He goes, "Oh, I'd love to have you guys, you know, sell your rifle with us, and what do you think of this? What do you think of that?" And I'm like, "Well, I like this kind of rail. You know, hey, why are you using this kind of buttstock?" At the time, we were the first manufacturer to basically OEM Mission First Tactical buttstocks. The first 100 minimalist buttstocks in the country. They went to us. We had actually at the time a great relationship with MFT. And so after having this conversation with the CEO, you know, a month and a half, 2 months later, they come out with a rifle that was gray, a very similar color gray to ours, and had a similar kind of name, and it had MFT furniture. And, you know, it wasn't outright theft, but it was kind of like, man, he kind of picked a lot of the ideas out of my brain, and I gave it away for free. So yeah. Now I'm just, and you know, and you're kind of getting into, you know, soft goods are really, I found a pretty cutthroat deal too, from talking to, you know, guys at Tac Taylor and a couple others. And, you know, it's the same thing. You really got to watch who you're talking to and what you give away and what you give away for free. And, even my old partner had learned that. He went to Sofic and some guys were picking his brain about some of our ideas, because we had ideas for drones. We had ideas for all kinds of things. And these guys were picking his brain, and a sergeant major from a certain tier one unit came up to James and knew him from another deployment and said, "Hey man, you need to stop talking. You need to not be giving this away for free. I don't talk to these guys. When I get out, I'm going to give them my rate, and my rate is going to be X amount of hundreds of dollars per hour. And that's what you should be doing right now. And it's true. Unfortunately, that's how it's got to be. There's no handshake deals anymore. There's no, hey man, like, this is kind of my idea. And it's super strange. And if I had to name one company that has never been rude to us, always kind of welcomed us with open arms, even when we were absolutely nobody. It's not to say now we're sort of somebody, but first SHOT Show, we were really nobody. And that was Knight's Armament. Trey Knight and his dad and his brothers have been super nice to us since we first met. Whereas other companies, some of them aren't in business anymore, were just absolutely rude to us. Like, who are you guys? What's this? I've got more designing notions in my insert a bad word here. And it was just, it was so weird. You're like, man, this is Knight's Armament. This is a multi-million-dollar company. They have no reason to even consider us on this platform. And then you have other companies that, you know, maybe a little scrappier, the exact opposite. It was just, it's kind of really eye-opening.
So it seems like from social media and just as far as production goes, you guys were really slaying it when you partnered with Nick Irving and kind of created the Reaper 33. And from my perspective, at least, it seems like you guys were a top tier weapons manufacturer, because the market is so completely saturated with AR-15s and AR-10s of all kinds of sorts. And everybody thinks that they have the latest and greatest. But you guys separated yourselves pretty well from that at Arsenal Democracy. And then after the Reaper 33 and kind of your guys' momentum, it seems like you guys fell off a little bit there and kind of went dark on social media and kind of had some issues. And I'd see in various forums and stuff like that people were bad mouthing Arsenal Democracy and your company because they weren't getting the orders that they had placed in.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. As a company, we had tremendous momentum in the very beginning. We sold out of like our first 100 rifles, the first 100 Reaper 33s, like it wasn't even a month, which for a company that didn't exist 2 months prior to that was a big deal. And we had plans in place. We had worked on the trigger. We had worked on the PDW stock that you saw and a couple other things. So we were just rocking and rolling. And the problem was, I mean, there are several problems, which I'll get into, but the problem was I was still an employee of the United States Army. So I really wasn't around as much as I could have been. You know, I could take leave and go to SHOT, and I could stop by the shop after I got done, when I wasn't in training or I wasn't deploying. And so James just kind of had his run of the place. And, you know, every time I would check in with James, he'd be like, yeah, everything's great, man. Everything's going good. And, you know, the numbers we were kind of locked out on. And, you start seeing stuff like that online. You start seeing, hey, what's this guy talking about? What's this thing on the forum? And you wouldn't really see anything on social media. At least I wouldn't see anything on social media. And, you know, come to find out that James had made several deals with a couple other companies, some of them not even related to the firearms industry. And he was just skimming money off the top. There's no really good way to say it. I mean, embezzlement is embezzlement. And, you know, was just scooping money off the top, was blowing off customers, had left close to 100 customers in the wind when, you know, we finally figured it out. I had been going through a med board to get out of the Army. When I finally did, I kind of had a chat with them. So I had a lot of friends in SF, and I still have my reputation. I spent my career building, and I said, I'm not going to be a part of this. I'm not going to have my name attached to this. And I walked. And about a week later, 2 weeks later, a couple members of the board overseeing the company reached out to me and said, hey, what's going on? We heard you left. And I just kind of went, hey, you know, business is not so cut and dry. For me, it's black and white. There's a lot of gray area apparently with this, and I'm taking a walk. I'm gonna start my own company. And they were like, "Ooh, let's have lunch." And we sat down and had lunch, and they said, "How do we fix this?" And I swear to God, I mean, it was over a beer. I pulled out a napkin and I made a list of what we do to fix this. And it was like such a simple, if you have, you know, any kind of morality, it's a really simple list. You got, it's like doing your stop the bleeding, you know, do that kind of thing. It was just, we've got to sit here. We've got to get rid of James. We've got to stop the bleeding. We've got to assess the damage, and we've got to see who do we owe rifles to. We need to take care of them before we even think about selling our first rifle, you know, back with the new design and coming out with anything else. And that's what we did. And it, you know, it's easier said than done. That was about, you know, it took about 9 months to do, to get to where we are now, where we've taken care of those guys. And, at the same time, you know, come out with, dusted off some of the old designs, come out with a couple new ones, and progressed further from there to kind of eclipse that bad stuff. And to this day, if there are any other people that feel like they've been wronged by the company and haven't been taken care of, I mean, I encourage them to reach out to me. I've tried to make myself one of the most accessible CEOs possible. I've put my number out there. I do, you know, 3 different social media sites. So, at this point, I think I've weeded out all the folks that have been wronged by the old AD.
So you and I had first met is more or less your passion behind the business and manufacturing process, and talking about your black side Glock, which I had my hands on for the first time at SHOT Show a few years ago. I noticed that you really focused on function before fashion, whereas it seems like everybody else nowadays is more worried about slide cuts and tie coating the barrel to make it all gold and just kind of getting flashy with it. So where does that kind of come from with your focus on the designs?
Well, and you and I touched on that then, and it was, I think a lot of gun makers are not necessarily gun users. And I don't mean that in a way that they don't go out to the range and shoot or maybe even compete, but in a professional capacity where your life really depends on it, you don't care how shiny your barrel is. It's more a matter of, does it work? Will it work when my hands are covered in hydraulic fluid? Will it work when my hands are bloody? You know, will it work when it's dirty? Will it work when it's dusty? Will it work when it's been submerged in salt water, when I swam on the objective, that kind of thing. And those are the things that kind of keep me up at night and drive the function over form design. And it's not to say that stuff doesn't look cool. I mean, some of this stuff does look really cool, but it's kind of a, you know, I used this analogy with you before, and that was, you know, there's doing PT to take your shirt off in the club. And then there's doing PT to be the fittest assaulter or the fittest sniper you can be, so that, you know, you can bust through that door on a breach, and you can, you know, pull your buddy in full kit off the objective if you need to. And when you train like that, you're still going to get fit and you're still going to have abs, you know, as a byproduct, as a side effect, you're going to be really fit looking, but you're training for a completely different purpose. It's kind of that way with making guns. These guns do look cool, but it's really just a side effect of all the function that we try and put in there, not just the form.
That's exactly something that I hit on in one of my blog posts, was talking about that very same thing, how, you know, everything is a byproduct. And if you focus on the necessary things in life to protect yourself, protect your family, and I mean, just protect the people, those byproducts are 9 times out of 10, you know, you're going to be fit. Your marksmanship game is going to be on point. Your situational awareness is going to be there. And so just all these good things come from practicing good habits. So your time overseas influenced your process of manufacture greatly. So tell us like some stories from that time that kind of directly correlated into things that you've kind of incorporated in the company now.
Well, you know, one of the main things in the design, people go, then the upper receiver, aside from it looking cool, is that it, you know, it has a forward assist. I've met a couple people in the industry that swear up and down you don't need a forward assist. It's completely unnecessary. It just added weight. It's not streamlined. You don't need it. And I guess maybe in the competition scene, that's true. I use the forward assist all the time. I actually, it's like a nervous tick. I use the forward assist because I had an incident in combat where I had main gun in the turret of our GMV go down, and we had guys bounding on us. And so I transitioned to my M4, and you know, I banged a bunch of rounds through it. You know, we'd gacked in, so there's a ton of dust and everything else on it. And I shot a full 30 rounds, keeping these guys down, putting a couple guys down, and I put a new magazine in. We were using HK mags, and they were pretty stiff. And I loaded this mag in, and I hit the bolt release, and I wanted to try and continue shooting. One of the benefits of being a lefty is that your right eye is always on the ejection port, so you always kind of have this, you have a constant situational awareness of when something goes wrong in the breech. And I could see that the round wasn't fully seated, and it was probably a dirty chamber, you know, on top of, you know, swollen brass, on top of, you know, the mag was too stiff. And so this guy was bounding at me. He'd just come over this hill, and he was, I don't know how many meters away, but, you know, this guy is just coming straight at us. And I remember with my, you know, the rifle grip in my hand, and with my other hand, I'm like furiously knife handing this forward assist. And I'm watching the round was incrementally going forward into the chamber until it finally went in the chamber, and it was like click. And I could just feel when it seated. And then I banged 5-6 rounds at him just to put him down. And I mean, it was one of those that was way too close a call. And so, you know, and you use the forward assist and everything else. You use the forward assist when you're loading a magazine as quietly as possible in the ORP. You use it you know, after a jump, if your jumping weapon's exposed, you know, you bang it, you got to go ahead and double check. So you get jostled, anything happens, you go, oh man, let me just hit that forward assist real quick. And it's something where it's always going to be a part of what I do. When I come out with the 308, it's going to have a forward assist. And then accuracy, you know, I'm such a stickler for accuracy just cause I think I'm kind of a perfectionist too. And you're a long range shooter. So accuracy is your life. And you know, it's one of those things where, people are like, oh, I just need 1 minute of man. That's all I need. And, I keep trying to tell people that haven't really been in a situation where you need to shoot somebody that, when it's for real and you're nervous and the adrenaline's flowing or whatever else, you'll have plenty of factors to help you miss. You'll have a ton of factors to help you miss. There won't be, you don't worry about it. There's all kinds of things that'll take care of it. Your heartbeat will be going crazy. Your gun will be dirty. You'll be using bad ammo. There'll be all kinds of stuff. You don't need how accurate the rifle is to add to that. So if I can make a gun that's 0.1 MOA, I'll make it. Because I know that real adrenaline and a real combat situation will just tack an MOA onto that. And yeah.
You know, it's funny you were talking about that and like that guy bounding at you. You and I were talking not too long ago about these reoccurring dreams or nightmares, or however you want to see it. I don't want to use the word nightmare, so it doesn't correlate with PTSD, but I think it's just like a shooter's thing. You know, in our sleep, we'll have a guy, you know, coming at us, or you know, we'll get up on him, and you know, you and I, like, we're trying to squeeze that trigger, and we just can't squeeze the trigger, and we're using two fingers on there, and still trying to like maintain sight picture, sight alignment, and just can't squeeze the trigger, dude. And that's like, oh, I wake up in like a dead sweat whenever that happens to me.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's funny we had that exact same dream, but yeah, I get the drop on this guy. I mean, it is a good righteous kill, and I absolutely have the drop on him, and he's starting to turn around, and that's when I'm squeezing the trigger, and that's when I go into panic mode because the trigger won't go back, and like you said, you go to two fingers, and you just you there's nothing more frustrating than that, because it's not you. It's not like you're hesitating. It's not like you're frozen. It's your gun. This thing that's supposed to help you do what you got to do, is what's holding you back. And like I said, I wake up in a cold sweat too. And then I immediately go find a gun somewhere and I start like polishing the trigger and see what I could do to make it work better. And, you know, I had an incident early in my career where I used a pistol for real too, and that's why I feel the way I do about that pistol and about the Black Side, because they're not just a secondary weapon. They could very, if your other weapon goes down, then it's your primary. If it's a situation where you don't have room for that weapon, it's your primary. If you're wearing NODs and your laser's down, but you have a laser or a red dot on your pistol, it's your primary. And I've seen so many other arguments. It's the same kind of minute of man argument, folks, that say stuff like, well, if you got to use your pistol, I mean, you're in trouble. I'm like, well, what if you're in trouble, man? I've been in trouble a couple times in combat, you know, and you put 10, 12 guys in a situation where they might go up against 200-300 people, you know, alone in a valley. That's trouble. You're by nature, your MOS is trouble. Yep. So, you know, I don't accept that. It's kind of like, you know, the forward assist argument. Well, if it wasn't meant to go in, I guess it just wasn't meant to go in. It's like, no, it's going in. That, if that's my last round, it's going in. If I got to get a rock and shotgun this thing, I'm going to do that. It's the same thing. It's the same thing with a pistol. When I used it, it was my primary. And, you know, it took five shots. I talk about combat marksmanship. You know, I was one of the better shots on the team. And, you know, I went from making these really tight little groups and shooting comps and shooting for beer overseas and whatever, to shooting this guy as best as I could in the trunk. And, you know, it was like neck, collarbone, you know, upper chest, lung. And this guy just didn't stop. And it kind of blew my mind, because I took two shots. I did, like, we always train for control pairs, and it was something that was kind of drilled into us in the mid 2000s. And I actually drilled this guy twice and then came back to position three. It's a story I tell. I came back to position three and I instantly knew I did the wrong thing. In my mind, I was like, what are you doing? Like, that guy's not down. And in slow motion, this might have influenced my nightmare, but in slow motion, I am pushing back out. I felt like I was pushing with, you know, all my force to push that gun back out to reindex and put three, four rounds this guy. And it wasn't until I hit him right in the middle of the bridge of the nose that the guy actually shut down. He was that determined to come at us. And, you know, it taught all of the people in us, and then as one, your whether it's your primary, your secondary, your tertiary, whatever comes after that, they're all your primary if that's what you have at that time. And they do all drill. You know, you shoot until the threat is gone. And we kind of changed the way we thought about a lot of things, not just guns, the way we trained and the way we fought after little incidents like that.
Good shit, man. Good shit.
Hey, so Dave, kind of rewinding a little bit. You went through the 18 X-ray program, so and you said you kind of finalized your decision to join the Army after 9/11. So then would that mean that you were one of the first waves of guys to go through the 18 X-ray program?
I was not one of the first waves. So, you know, I think the X-ray program, they brought back the SF program. I think it was called SF baby program or baby SF program in the 80s. They shut it down. And then after 9/11, I want to say it was sometime in mid to early 2002 is when they started the 18 X-ray program up again. And I was at the Citadel during 9/11 at the time. And you and I talked about how I'm originally from New York. And I still had family in New York at the time. And you know, for two or three days, there was no phone contact. I mean, if you were in town at the time, you know, like, cells were down, landlines were down, everything was down.
Yeah.
So for two or three days, I actually thought my mom was dead on 9/11. And it was such a helpless feeling, you know, just it totally, it changed my, body chemistry. And I was like, I know I have to join. I know I have to do something. I have to do this SF. And, it turns out she was alive, thank God. And, but it wasn't like, oh, okay, well, never mind then. It was a feeling that just wouldn't go away. This nagging feeling that you can't just ignore stuff on the global stage anymore, because it will find you. And, so I finished out school. That was one thing. She was like, if I was dead, that's one thing. I'm alive. You're going to finish college. So I finished, the Citadel. I graduated from there. And, I didn't take a commission, and I instead enlisted, it was right around by the time I was able to get through everything with all the maps and the delayed entry program or whatever else. It was almost the time we were hitting Iraq. It was like April or maybe March of 2003. And that's when I started that program, which was a pretty long pipeline.
Yeah, I know that the SF pipeline is some of the longest, if not the longest, in the entire military.
And I mean, I think it breeds maturity. It's not a one and done kind of thing, and it kind of weeds out. There's plenty of opportunities to wash yourself out. To whether you go from this phase or that phase, you can screw up on your off time and be done. There's kind of a zero tolerance thing there, or you can decide it's not for you, or you can get injured. There's a ton of, it was such a meat grinder and such a long road that it was a real gut check, especially for medics. 18 deltas, go ahead and tack a year onto that.
It's funny you said that too, because last time I was on rotation back from Baghdad when I was contracting, one of my best friends, we were in the Army together. We're in 1st ID over in Germany, and then we're at Fort Carson together in 4th ID. And as soon as I got out, he went to a selection, and he ended up getting picked up and tested to go be a Delta or a medic. And so I came back a few months ago on my rotation, and he hit me up, and he's like, hey, what are you doing? I was like, oh, I just got back to San Diego. He's like, well, I'm in Yuma right now in Halo school. Like, can me and my boys come down? I'm like, yeah, dude, you can come stay with me. So it was a good time having him and like 7 of those Halo classmates out. But dude, I'm telling you what, dude, we could have ran downtown having a bunch of ODA dudes and former battalion guys knocking out Halo school. But we were talking that night, and I'm like, are you done yet? Like, are you finally like on a team? He's like, I am now. And that was 3 years ago that I got out, and the same time he went to selection. So I was like, Jesus, dude, like, you finally got your break and you finally got assigned into a team.
Yeah. That's like, that was kind of a deciding factor for not really wanting to go in SF as an officer too. People were like, why don't you be an SF officer, to include a lot of officers? I mean, I had a lot of officers that knew me at the Citadel who, been an officer, and it just kind of didn't add up, because what did I want to do? I mean, sure, being a leader doesn't necessarily mean you're an officer. A lot of times it doesn't mean that at all. It means the opposite. But, you look at officers in the officer pipeline, you're going to spend however long in a line unit, whether you're a fire maneuver guy or whatever else. And then, you're going to spend probably 2 years in the Q course and then officer team time as a detachment commander. So, being on the ground with your guys is maybe, maybe 48 months, maybe a little bit longer if you're lucky, or it's in between rotations or something. So you're talking about 7 years between mine and then doing the course, and then you're going to spend 2 years on a team. That just didn't add up to me. So I was like, no, I want to do this pipeline where I go directly in SF. I'm going to suck in the course and everything else. But then I went on to spend, almost 10 years on a team. And that just, that was exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to be the guy on the team, even a senior guy on the team, but I wanted to be on a team as long as I possibly could.
Yeah.
So if you're going to spend 3 years in the Q course, you want to try to hang on to being a team guy for as long as you possibly can. So if I was a Delta, can I tell you a secret? I actually, I was going to be an 18 Delta. I attested for all the, my scores were good and everything else. And I remember seeing on my packet, when you finish selection and you, at least back then, we went to this loading dock where they go and receive you, and they take all your all your files and everything else, I saw that it said 18 Delta, and I kind of I yanked that out of my folder. And the lady was like, "What are you supposed to be?" And I said, "I'm an 18 Charlie, ma'am." And I knew some of the guys in the 18 Charlie committee because I had some downtime at one point, and I got detailed to work out at the 18 Charlie Ranch. I had helped them build a couple culverts and the actual bleachers where I was an 18 Charlie later on as a student. And so they recognized me, and they were like, "Hey, Dave, what's up? Yeah, this guy's a Charlie all the way." And the lady was like, "Okay, 18 Charlie," and stamped it. And I was like, "Yes, I've controlled my own destiny." And it's funny because I actually kind of did the same thing with choosing seventh group, because I think I was slotted to maybe go to first group or first or fifth group, I want to say. And I wanted to go to seventh, and I already knew how to speak Spanish from before. So I can't remember when I took the actual DLPT, but I managed to take a DLPT and score like a 2+ without ever having gone to language school. So not only did I knock off language school, but I also, it was like, boom, Spanish. So I'm in one place to go, seventh group. So I kind of scored big there too. So I kind of steered my own career, at least at the beginning, by doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's interesting. So for the audience who's not familiar, each Special Forces group is assigned to a geographical location where they would specialize in the language and the customs. Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, you've got 7th group, which is where I was at, where 7th group actually has one of the largest areas of responsibility. It's over 32 countries between South and Central America and the Caribbean. You've got 1st group that focuses primarily on Asia. 10th and 3rd have their AORs, 5th being the Middle East. But, since the advent of the GWAT, basically everyone's had, it's like, yeah, you've got that. And then you've also got Afghanistan and Iraq. So everyone was like, everyone's focused on the Middle East. So, we had this kind of thing where, peacetime SF, if there's really such a thing, those guys would do their J-sets and do their trips to, South America or to the Philippines or wherever their AOR was, and then, rotate off, do training, and then rotate back on again. But, since 9/11, SF groups were, you've still had that mission, you're still doing that for the theater commander, and then rather than rotate off and take a break, you kind of would switch over to going to Afghanistan or going to Iraq. And then you come back and then maybe do some training. And I think that's kind of contributed, that kind of nonstop schedule has kind of contributed to, a lot of guys getting burned out, because that's not really how it was designed to be, at least not for this long. This has been a super long conflict, especially Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much on a previous episode, I've had a guy that you're friends with, Michael Rodriguez, who's a former 18 Delta.
Yep.
And one of the things we were talking about was the effects that some of the battlefield medics were having on medicine on the civilian side of the house in the States or even abroad in the UK. And, one thing he did say was that, never in our history have our warfighters been this experienced because of the length of the conflict. So, guys are having so many rotations, and then, for the younger guys who are just getting in or getting ready to go through, their instructors are all guys with combat experience, So I think it, in the way of, it enriches the current generation and the next generation and for guys going forward,
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you said it, it's an unprecedented time, and if there's anything, war, aside from industry, breeds incredible innovation. And, you look at World War II, the space program is around because of some of the rocket tech, that both sides were coming up with. Now, if you and I, God forbid, got shot on the street and went to the hospital, they'd be able to save us 10 times more likely we'd make it, because of the innovations and everything we've learned from traumatic medicine in the last 15 plus years. And, there's innovations in everything, in weapons technology. You know, Nick and I talked about that in optics, in ammunition, in body armor, you know, making things lighter. And then, you know, Mike and I have touched on that stuff too. And that's all the medical tech. You look at CAT tourniquets, you know, before the tourniquet, I remember, you know, even early on in basic training, they were like, okay, the tourniquet's your last resort and you can only have it on for like 4 hours and you better write the time on his forehead or else they're 4 hours and 1 minute, they're going to cut that limb off. And you only do it if it's a last resort. It was like this crazy, you know, you're like, oh my God, a tourniquet. I don't want a tourniquet, you know, but after you start training with, you know, with guys who've really been in combat, by 05, 06, we're like, oh no, you get hit in the arm, you're putting a tourniquet on. You get hit in your thigh, we're putting a tourniquet on. You get hit in your toe, we're putting a tourniquet on. Because they figured out how many people were dying from bleeding out from what they perceived to be a, you know, just a small extremity wound that they just never shut off. And we know that stuff now, and they've developed better tourniquets. They've got that, those shorts, those pressure shorts. I mean, they just so many different, new inventions and new techniques. I mean, doing crikes. I had to do live crikes on people in combat. I unfortunately had been present for a couple of suicide bombings, and you know, all the things that I learned how to do that later on, I was in Sephardic and we were doing live training. We'd gone in, done a hit, and you know, instructors were like, okay, now we got, you know, assaulters that are shot. So, okay, you're shot, this guy's shot, this guy's hurt. All right, you come here, you're the assault force sergeant major. Come here and start analyzing this guy. I'm like, okay, all right, man. And got there and he goes, all right, he's got a wound in his upper abdomen. You know, he's got this. I start going through the whole thing. I'm like, all right, okay, I'm going to look for an exit wound. All right, no exit wound. Okay, you know, this guy is conscious. He's, you know, in the ABPU scale. And we just went through this. And we went back and forth with this guy who was a medic for like 10 minutes. And it finally got to the point where he stumped me. I mean, he just absolutely stumped me. So like, he asked some crazy thing and I went, I really don't know, man. I'm out. I'm fresh out. And he goes, what kind of medic are you? And I was like, I'm not a medic. I'm an 18 Charlie. And it went, Oh, dude, I thought you were an 18 Charlie or an 18 Delta, man. That's awesome then. Yeah. You really had me going for a while. So, I mean, to fool another 18 Delta into thinking that you're a Delta for, you know, 10 plus minutes, because you just have that much hands-on training and experience in the medical field, you know, that says something. Because, you know, before it was like, you were a badass if you knew how to give an IV. And now we've got guys who are essentially line guys in SF, who are commo guys or weapons guys, who are doing crikes in the dark, who are, you know, doing cut downs, doing everything else that, you know, that was a big deal for combat lifesavers 20 years ago.
And that's what's so great about the SF community is you guys cross-train so frequently together. And I think it's just all small communities because, you know, we even kind of had it in recon too, where we would get our FSOs in there and teach us how to call fire. And we would go over to the JTAC house and have those guys teach us how to talk to fixed wings. And it's all about just gaining as much knowledge as possible and kind of building out that book that we can draw from overseas in order to figure out how best to take, you know, handle a situation, because maybe calling in artillery is probably not the best thing for collateral damage. So what would you do then? Well, you know, then you can call in fixed wings or aircraft or, you know, depending on the distance, even snipers, and just trying to take everything from all avenues. And I hope that's something that the military is going to continue to do, is enforce the cross-training between everybody. But right now, or at least when I was in, it seemed like it was only in the smaller units.
Yeah, and I don't know what that is. I don't know if that's just because,
you know, I think it's laziness.
No, I mean, it's also, you know, everything gets lost when it gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah,
it goes that way for companies too. But if you're you know, 10 guys, if you're 20 guys, 30 guys, it's a lot easier to get together in a round table and talk about it instead of layers and layers and layers of bureaucracy to have a committee to think about what we could possibly train on in the future. Oh, let me send a memo about that. I think that's where you have more and more layers to get through to get to that decision point, to even decide what kind of extra training you need. So you just killed all this time getting there. It's like, it goes back to, like, you know, look at mission planning. we had a more inexperienced guy at one point, and he was like, all right, so we're going to plan for a mission. And, okay, so we'll break up into three groups, you know, the old like MDMP, you know, get three courses of action. Mm-hmm. You have by air, you have by sea. And,
most likely, like, most dangerous, most probable.
Yeah. So we went through, you know, 3 hours of this little exercise to basically, guess what? All three groups came up with something that was about 97% the same. And we could have just got around a sand table and come up with the same plan in 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And just cut out a lot of the BS and sit there and just go, you know, okay, no, we've got insertion, we've got infiltration, we've got actions on the objective, we've got exfil, and then we've got our debrief. Let's just focus on that. And it, you know, as later on when I got to the SIF, it became even more compressed. And the main thing you focused on were all your contingencies. If you had your contingencies covered, then you know the actual actions on the objective were. And it was demonstrated to us by the commander out there. He's like, look, you guys got 5 minutes to plan for this mission. You know, you've got your GRGs, you've got whatever else, but you know, it's a house. It's got four walls. There's maybe a couch in there. There's you know, some bad guys. You know, if you hit this door and it doesn't open, what are you going to do? I go, oh, well, our SOP says to do this. He goes, okay, great. What are you going to do if this happens? Yeah, we do this. So everyone knew the plan and everyone knew how to CQB at this point. So we were just like, all right, so what's the real thing we need to spend this 5 minutes on? How about like where the medevac is going to land if somebody gets shot, or you know, if the hostage is messed up, or what are we going to do if there's a vehicle goes down? That was the stuff that we focused on, and it was that rapid planning cycle. If you just cut out some of that bureaucracy and that BS, that's not to say don't plan, you know, don't run it by the seat of your pants and do something like that, or you're gonna wind up like that SDV team that there was a movie about recently. But if you know your TTPs and you know what you're doing and you plan on the stuff that could go wrong, then the stuff that could go right, you're already trained for.
Yeah. Hey Nick, so just a question on to go back to some of the tourniquet use. You know, obviously in a 12-man special forces team, you know, they cross-train and stuff like that. But so you were in the infantry in Iraq and Afghanistan. Did you, like you specifically, did you carry around a tourniquet, or did you guys just kind of leave that up to the medics or the guys who were a little higher qualified in medicine?
Oh, absolutely not, dude. Every single dude had a tourniquet on them. And even then, they had one in their IFAC. And then they would have one, because depending on the types of camo that we had cry at the end. You'd wear the cat in your little like thigh pocket, and you'd take it because it has like a red like pull band on the end of it, and you'd fold that over on the outside of the pocket, so that way if you were messed up, medic or whoever could immediately see where your tourniquet was. And it was mandatory that you kept in the same pocket for every single person. And even then, you know, I still had some, so I had one on my right calf, like down low. And then I had one that was rubber band to my chest rig. And then I had one of my IFACs. So I had three on me at all times. And that was first and foremost, like priority, like every single person, even down to like the retard, you know, like the guy that you wouldn't even trust with a pencil. Like even that guy was pretty good at putting on a tourniquet. We made damn sure of that, because that's nothing to play around about.
Right. Right. And I know, Dave, it's interesting because, you know, I've had a bunch of SF guys on previously and you know, guys who were in the SIF and different special forces groups. And one thing that was brought up was we kind of talked about the bureaucracy that led to some of the failure of the response to Benghazi. And, you know, it's something that the operators of this kind of particular time, like, you know, the last 4 or 5 years are dealing with more than guys who were deploying during the early to mid 2000s. You know, kind of with the change of the rules of engagement and really just the added layers of bureaucracy. And an example was given about how they wanted to run like a basic route reconnaissance, and it took like I forget the exact time. I don't want to throw a number out there, but it was something that was really ridiculous amount of time for them to get a response for something so basic. And I think it was something like a week or even a little longer than that. And I know that that's something that frustrates some of the guys who are out deployed now, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, you brought up Benghazi, and I knew guys in the SIF who were there. That you know, they're based out of Europe, and that SIF unit was actually kitted up doing a full mission profile. And, you know, as a SIF, we're always travel with a package, and that package has certain loadouts and certain things for, you know, a contingency just like that. And those guys were on standby. They could have been wheels up and wheels back down in probably 3 hours, maybe four. And, you know, if you've never seen what an entire SIF company can do, I mean, if you were to drop a fully armed SIF company into that situation, I mean, it would be a much different movie. And, it's super frustrating. And I, you know, the CONOP joke was kind of something that, is passed around in SF and in, some of MARSOC and some of the SEALs. And it's, a CONOP is what you have to submit in order to do an operation. It's your concept of the operation. And, you know, we went from the early days of putting out what we used to call a 5Ws, and that was a Windows text document. I mean, it was like you could have sent it with an embedder. It was such little data. And it was just a 5Ws of where you're going to go, what you're going to do, with who. And, you know, it was that easy. They would see that 5Ws and go yes or no. It was almost always yes. And you went ahead and did it. And then the CONOP started becoming one page, and you had to throw the illustrations with it and, you know, do your PowerPoint. And then it started growing into, okay, well, this is like we're involving more assets and you want air and you want to do this. That's a level 2 CONOP, or a level 3 or a level 4 or level 1. And they grow larger and larger to the point where CONOPs were starting to be 12, 14 pages that you'd have to do submit. And that's a tremendous amount of work for not just for the team to plan and prep for, but, you know, for the team leader and team sergeant and warrant to sit there and wrap this whole thing up and submit it and sit there and wait. And what kind of timeline did you have to actually get that approved? And, you know, I started experiencing that. We experienced that in, you know, some of my later, OEF trips and especially in Iraq, cause we were a SIF there doing stuff with a tier one organization. And, you know, even they had their frustrations especially because we went through the transition between Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation New Dawn. And, you know, it's gotta be frustrating. I'm out now. I've been out for a little over a year, and, it's gotta be frustrating for the new guys. My only advice I could give is use the system that the bureaucrats have created to slow you down, to just slow them down. An example is I myself and another teammate of mine, we'll call him Hoot, wanted to go do a kind of sniper 3-day recce thing. And really, we just wanted to set up on this one area overlooking this pass to look for guys putting in IEDs. And we knew it was going to take forever to get this operation blessed off, and it was probably going to be something where, well, gun trucks had to be within this amount of space, and we didn't want it to be all that. We just wanted to come in with ATVs under nods, using waddies, passive IR only, and come in, stash them, climb this mountain, get on there, set up guns, and then do what we got to do for 3 days. And we knew that it was either going to be take so long to approve or outright get shut down that I just played on the rules. And so I submitted a 5Ws for Steno. And I remember I wrote it up as Steno. And I knew the AST, he was kind of the liaison, the LNO for our company and our SOTA. And I knew he was going to report it. So, you know, at the Cub, the commander's update brief, I knew they were going to go, okay, ODA 732 is going to conduct Steno in this area, you know, just a kind of a low profile operation. And I knew that it's the nature of high ranking officers and bureaucrats and even SF guys to never act like you don't know something. And Steno is, Nick, you're a you are a scouts guy and probably, you know, mess with LURS guys. You know that STANO stands for Surveillance and Target Acquisition Night Operations. And so I knew that most of those guys didn't know that unless they happened to be in like a LURS unit or something like that. And so I could just imagine the commander being like, oh, STANO. Yeah, STANO. Awesome. It's been a, yeah, we should get more guys doing some of that STANO. That's good. It's you should really, yeah, I was sure that's what happened. And so we were able to go and do these operations. We did them, you know, we probably did three or four before they caught on. And
why are all these dead dudes in the field?
Who are all these guys just getting smoked, just getting fed to the crows while they're trying to put in IEDs? And it was just, you know, it was, I mean, it was still stuff that we would go, you know, if you've got troops in contact, you're still calling troops in contact. It, you know, it is what it is. And eventually, you know, they connected the dots. You do a couple of those and it's just, you know, what are you going to do? But then you just change your tactics again. You got to be unconventional in dealing with, you know, some of your own command. And, you know, it's not breaking the rules. Nobody did. We didn't break any rules. We submitted A5Ws. It was approved. And we went ahead and we did it. I even used, you know, U.S. Army doctrine and acronyms. So it's just you. I would have to say do that and outsmart. You got to outsmart the bad guys now, and you've got to outsmart some of your own commanders. Yeah. But it works, and that's what SF guys and unconventional guys do. You got to use your brain. That's your 3-pound weapon. It won't get any lighter, but it's probably your best weapon in today's kind of ambiguous. Battlefield where guys are, if you're faced with getting smoked or, you know, maybe doing the wrong thing, but ending your career, you're kind of, you've got to outthink your way out of something like that. There's no out shooting your way out of it. I wish it was easier, but it's not.
Right. Right. Okay. So for anyone who's listening, for the audience, if they wanted to keep up with you, where can they go to follow you on social media, or if they wanted to check out some of your rifles and that kind of thing, where can they go for that?
Well, they can, our website is arsenaldemocracy.us and, yeah, pretty simple interface, and they can just go in the arms room and it shows the different guns. And then it's got a link, a live gallery to our Instagram feed, which is, same name, arsenal_democracy, and, our Facebook page, same name, Arsenal Democracy. And, yeah, I mean, we, you know, on our Instagram, there's several pictures of our guns, some of our different projects, some of our R&D projects that we're working on. And then, a couple pictures, flashback pictures we do every now and then of times when I was on a team and some of the other guys who work with me were on teams and, been in Afghanistan and Iraq, and kind of throw that in the mix too.
Awesome. Awesome. So on the podcast notes on my website, like, you know, that's where people can go to click the links if they don't go directly to iTunes or SoundCloud. I'll list all those links and have people jump over to your site.
Awesome, man. I appreciate it.
No worries, man. I just want to thank you for coming on. And, you know, I know the audience is going to appreciate to hear from a guy like yourself. And, you know, just again, thank you for everything you've done.
Hey, thank you, John. And thanks, Nick. And, yeah, hopefully I can hop on again. It's been fun.
Yeah, for sure, man.
Yeah, man. We'll catch up at a shot.
All right, bro. That's a deal.
So now, right now, we're going to listen to the interview that John had with Stu Pearson and kind of get his story and his experiences over in Afghanistan and how he made it out of there. Hopefully, you guys can understand him since he has pretty much the thickest accent that me and John have ever heard since Braveheart.
Hey, what's going on, guys? For this episode, my guest is Stu Pearson. And Stu was a paratrooper in the British Army with 3 para. And Stu served for 20 years. He was wounded in Afghanistan. And, we'll talk about that incident. And so, Stu, how's it going?
About John, you all right? Yeah, yourself?
Yeah, I'm good, man. I just want to thank you for coming on. I know it's kind of late over there.
Yeah, no worries, man.
Yeah, so, Stu, let's... You know, so a lot of Americans, you know, there's a huge community of people who support veterans in America, you know, supporting American veterans and as well as British veterans. But I don't think people are very familiar with
you know, units like the paras and, you know, some of the more specialized infantry units. So the paras are basically an elite light infantry unit?
Yeah, more or less, basically the same as the 82nd Airborne in America.
Okay, right. So, you know, in this global war on terror, you know, between Iraq and Afghanistan, the paras were deployed to both war zones, right?
That's correct, yeah. We were first into Iraq with the British, the first of the British troops into Iraq, and the first of the British troops into Helmand in Afghanistan in 2006.
Okay, and up in Helmand province, Afghanistan, is that where the incident occurred where you were wounded?
Yes, that's where I was injured myself, yeah.
Okay.
So let's talk just like a little bit about, you know, kind of, so you're from Scotland, right?
Yeah, so yeah, just outside Glasgow.
Okay, and in Scotland, you know, if someone's in Scotland and they want to join the army, you know, there's recruiting station and then you would process and ship out to wherever it is that you go through, like your basic training.
Yeah, that's basically the role how it happens. Yeah, go to the recruiting office and then they get the ball rolling then, and then it's a series of things before you actually join up. Takes maybe about up to maybe 6 months from initially going to the recruiting office.
Okay, so. You know, all right, so now that, you know, you joined in, when was your first deployment to a war zone?
I first went to Northern Ireland when I was 19, that would have been. Hi.
Yeah, I think you broke up for a second.
First went in operations was to Northern Ireland when I was 19 years old.
Okay, now I've read a couple of books about British military and then Northern Ireland as well, and I know, I guess compared to how it was, you know, maybe 40 years ago, it's calmed down a lot over there, right?
Yeah. I mean, when I was there, it was mostly tours that were during kind of ceasefire times, so there wasn't really much going on, but certainly times in the 1970s and 80s, it was pretty wild. Yeah, it was pretty wild there.
Yeah, so that was an issue between two different groups, and I know it lasted for a number of years, and I guess at some point it kind of calmed down a little bit. But so for years, the British military was sending units up there to try and help kind of maintain that peace, right?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, they first went in there to help the Catholics out as such. They were getting a lot of aggro from the Protestants on the other side of the river as such.
Right. Okay, so now you were, when you were wounded, let's fast forward a little bit, it was at Kajaki Dam, and that's in Helmand Province. Mm. Now, what was the job that you guys were doing there at the time?
Yeah, I was a anti-tanks section commander.
Okay, and you guys were assigned to secure the rebuilding of the dam?
Not so much rebuilding. Basically, we were there to protect the dam because from basically getting overrun by Taliban, because the hilltops we were on were the biggest hilltops in the area. And I'm sure, as you can understand, once you've got the highest ground, you've basically got the area. So that was basically, we were there to overwatch the dam to stop it getting into enemy hands as such.
Right. And I know that the British wanted to kind of get the dam running again to provide power to the entire Helmand province, was that it?
That's right, yeah. I mean, they eventually got up and running, I think, 2 years later or something. But I think it was up and running, but I just think they needed a new, they need new parts to get it fully up and running, but it was still going, but it just wasn't at its 100%.
Okay, and that was something that Taliban had put a priority on to try and disrupt from taking place, right?
Well, I'm not too sure what the intelligence on it of it was as to if they were actually going to be a direct threat to there, but it was basically an important part to keep because the dam itself provided something like 75% of power to Helmand Province. So if we were to lose the dam, you know what I mean, that would have been literally all the electricity lost in actual Helmand Province.
Right, and Helmand Province is a pretty like notoriously bad part of Afghanistan for a number of years.
Yeah, more or less. It was kind of untouched. In the 5 years from 2001 to 2006 that British and American troops had been there, it was hardly touched. It was a kind of safe haven for the Taliban. They could really get away with anything.
Yeah, I know it's still kind of a troubled area. I mean, earlier this year in January, there was a American Special Forces soldier who was killed in southern Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just goes to show, you know, how dangerous of a place it is, even after all these years, you know?
Yeah, yes, I know. It's a bad place, yeah.
So now So can we talk a little bit about the incident where you were wounded?
Yeah, sure, John, yeah.
Okay, so it initially started out as a some kind of reconnaissance patrol, and then is that how it began?
Stu Hale, the sniper that was with us, he wanted to do a snipe on the Taliban he'd seen the night before, setting up an illegal vehicle checkpoint, and it was too far away for him to get the snipe from where we were on the hilltops. So he came up with a plan of heading 700 metres south onto a ridge line near the target area that he was confident he could get a snipe on. And he never got that far, really. And it just went pretty bad.
Yeah, so basically what happened was, and there's a movie, if the audience is interested, there's a movie that was made about this specific incident. And what is the name of that, Stu, the movie?
It's called, in Britain it's called Kijaki, the True Story, but in America it's called Kilo 2 Bravo.
Kilo 2 Bravo, and and people can watch that in the States on Netflix, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, so basically, so you guys decided, the sniper decided they wanted to make this movement to get closer to this Taliban checkpoint, and in their movement to make it to their position, they happened to walk into a landmine field, basically.
Unfortunately, yeah, Stu here, watch, accidentally trod on a mine en route, halfway to go to the ridge line he was aiming for, and the rescue operation was then mounted once he stood in that.
Right, and it wasn't a landmine, it wasn't a minefield that was set by the Taliban. That was what is called or known as a legacy minefield, which is basically mines that the Russians left behind, you know, from that time. It must have been like 30 years, 25 years, something like that.
Yeah, that's correct. About 20 years from when the Russians were there during the occupation. They basically, the mines had just washed down the hillsides and all congregated in the actual wadi where everything happened. And it could have been a lot worse than what it was. Although it was a hideous day and it was a terrible outcome, it could have been a lot worse because there was a lot of mines down there.
Right, and I know that's something that the Russians did in a lot of parts of Afghanistan. Either it was while they were there, like throughout the process, the time that they were there, or when they were making their exit, they just laid down an incredible amount of mines. And I know for years after the Russians left, there were organizations that would go in there and attempt to you know, get rid of as many of these mines as possible, because really a lot of the local population would end up stepping on these mines, like just going through their daily business, and then further complicating the effort in Afghanistan for, you know, Western forces, American, British, you know, there were mines everywhere. And what you guys went through was really an example of how bad that can be.
Yeah, that's correct. I think there was something like 10 million mines or something laid there by the Russians and that. So, yeah, it was a pretty hairy place to be.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. 10 million mines, that's a lot of munitions. So initially, was it the sniper who stepped on the mine?
It was, yeah. He stood in the mine, lost his right leg.
Okay, so he stepped on the mine, and then I know that there are procedures for maneuvering through a minefield. And in the movie, it was illustrated on how that's done. And it's kind of a very slow process, but necessary, obviously.
Yeah, obviously, yeah. It's a slow process, but it's something that's got to be slow and got to be precise, and as precise as we could get, and methodical. For things to happen, yeah.
So you guys were in the process of getting the sniper who initially stepped on the mine out, and then was that when you ended up stepping on the mine?
Yeah, well, initially I asked for a helicopter with a winch to extract us out there, but this was denied, so I knew I had to look for an area that was I felt was flat enough and big enough to get a helicopter, not too much land in, but certainly get his back wheels down to put the casualty onto. And unfortunately, on doing this, I then stood in a mine myself and lost my left leg.
Okay, and you stepped on the mine directly, or was it like kind of next to where you were stepping? How was that?
I stood on it directly, so yeah.
Okay, and then, so after that, I think, was it then that the initial helicopter came in?
It was, yes. I mean, I got immediate first aid from Alec Craig, a medic, who was down there with us, and Colonel Mark Wright, he came up to me as well to get my details, so that he could pass my details up the chain of command, so that the personnel, so that the operations center knew what was going on and who was injured, etc. And a Chinook helicopter was brought in then, and that detonated a third mine that was right beside me.
Right, and I know that eventually, I think it was because of the downdraft from the Chinook that it set off another mine, injuring another guy.
Yeah, that third mine there went off, and it injured me further, and Mark Wright, who was standing over me, it badly injured him, and he was blasted away by it, and he caught some bad injuries from that as well.
Now, how long was it? What was the total time that you guys, that the first sniper stepped on the mine to the time that all of you guys were evacuated out?
Around about 4 hours, something like that, four and a half hours or something.
Okay, and so you guys you needed this winch. What exactly is a winch for people who wouldn't know what that is?
Yeah, how can you describe it? I'm trying to think how you describe it. Basically, like a paramedic will come down a long rope from a helicopter to give first aid to an injured person, us that were injured in the minefield, and it can do that from like 50 to 60, 70 foot above, rather than having the downdraft from a helicopter, which, as we've seen from the third mine that went off, it could set it off, so it can do it, and the medic can do it in rough safety as such.
Right, so basically, it's like a special piece of equipment, and I guess it works better, or it can work very well in a situation like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, yeah.
When the Chinook came into the wadi, did you guys already know that there was a danger that it could set off a mine?
Yes, we knew that because I think by the time I stood in the mine, that was then everyone's realization that this wasn't just one lone mine that Stu stood on. We kind of knew then that this is probably a minefield now. So we didn't want that Chinook to come down, but that's what they sent in for us.
Right. And initially, so I guess for like a helicopter to be equipped with that equipment, there would have to be kind of like a specialized medic on board to complete that?
That's correct, yeah, that's correct, yeah.
So, okay, so when you guys were lifted out, it was an American PJ unit that came in?
Yeah, basically, when our commanding officer got a heads up of what was going on, he initially asked for the American Blackhawks from Kandahar, but it was denied any. It was denied. It basically said there was too much red tape or whatever in the way. But we initially didn't get them. But then when the third mine got detonated by the Chinook, we got the Blackhawks released for us, and I think two of them came in and evacuated us out one at a time with them to then rendezvous with the Chinook about a mile away from us, and they then flew us back to Bastion from there.
So the Chinooks, they're not capable of using a winch?
None of them were equipped with winches at that stage.
Okay. So how many soldiers was it in total that were wounded that day at that particular incident?
There was seven of us wounded, including Mark, who lost his life. So there was seven of us all in.
Okay, and that was seven guys from 3 Para?
That's correct, yeah, seven of us.
Okay, and now that, so, you know, when you get wounded, and I don't know, I know that Americans will eventually get evacuated, like, to Germany. I'm not sure if it's the same for the British military. So do you go, like, to a field hospital and then you get evacuated onto a different facility, like, outside of Afghanistan?
Yeah. We were evacuated back to Bastion, the main base. A field hospital was there, and numerous operations on me. And then after 2 days there, we then get flown back to England and went to Birmingham to a hospital called Selly Oak Hospital, where straight in the operating theatre, and operations carried on from there, and I stayed there for around 7 weeks.
Now, that 7 weeks, was that the initial care and then recovery process, or was that the initial care and then, like, did you have to go through a process where you had to, like, learn how to move again, that kind of thing?
The actual 7 weeks, that was basically the initial care, because although my left leg was gone, that was gone. There was no way back for that. The main worry was my right leg, because my right leg was like 90. The surgeons were 90% certain I'd lose my right leg, but thanks to the surgeons and all the medics involved, they managed to save my right leg. So mine was a bit longer, as in 7 weeks rather than just a few weeks for a few of the guys would have. And then from there, we were then transferred to our rehabilitation centre. We were then given prosthetic legs and that to walk with.
Okay, and then after you made your recovery, you continued to serve in the British Army, correct?
That's right, yeah, for another 6 years before I was discharged.
Okay, and did you stay with the 3 Paras? Or you went out to a different unit?
Yeah, I stayed with 3 Para. 3 Para are really good about it, and they found me jobs within the battalion. And the army were actually really good in general, but yeah, 3 Para are really good.
Yeah, that's awesome. It, you know, a lot of guys like yourself will go through like some terrible injuries received on the battlefield, but I think they, on the American side and obviously on the British side, they do a very good job of taking care of guys when they come home. So I know the Scottish have a very, like, rich, you know, history and and serving in the military and that kind of thing. Are there a lot of Scottish natives who serve in the infantry units and the paras and stuff like that?
I think there is. I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but I think there is quite a lot, especially in the parachute regiments made up of a lot of Scots and Scots and Geordies, you know, from north of England and stuff.
Yeah. So, and Scotland geographically is north of England, right?
That is, yes, north of England, yeah.
And I know, like, a lot of the, like, the terrain is rough. There's a lot of mountains, and I guess that's pretty good for military training, infantry training, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's good mountainous terrain there. So, yeah, plenty of hill fitness in there.
Right, right. And so, like, is there... So, like, you're in Scotland, right? You join the army. Does everything take place, like, south in England, or is some of that take place in Scotland itself?
I think they have the... I think they have the pre-selection before you join the army. I think that's in Scotland, but all the main training, that gets done in England. Certainly for the infantry, it's north of England in Catterick, which is only about 100 miles or something from Scotland itself.
Okay, okay. So I noticed, because I watched the film Kilo 2 Bravo, and, you know, one thing that, so on this show before, I've had, like, you know, special operations medics. I've had Chantel Taylor on the show,
mm-hmm.
who you know, and she was a combat medic with the British Army.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk about things about, like, how important, you know, tourniquets are and that sort of thing. So in the movie, it showed that you guys were using tourniquets. And, you know, the tourniquet use has helped the Global War on Terror have, like, record high number of survivors from battlefield wounds. And it's something that's being talked about, at least here in the States, where... you know, guys are coming home after 15 years of war, you know, 20 years of in the service, and applying some of the medical techniques and tourniquet use to civilian medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And so would you say that the tourniquet use is something that, like, helped you survive your ordeal?
Definitely, yeah. Without a shadow of a doubt, yeah. It's, yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic, it's a simple bit of equipment, but it's life-saving.
Right, right, and I think a majority of wounds on the fatalities on the battlefield are from people bleeding out and stuff like that.
Flush, yeah, as yeah.
Right, and it's just something that, you know, it's something that's common in at least in the States on the civilian side as well, where a lot of people will bleed out before they get to the hospital or something like that, and it's just something that, you know, we're trying to raise awareness to and kind of have people understand that how important it would be to have, you know, a nice percentage of the population trained on tourniquet use and that sort of thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it doesn't need to be an actual tourniquet. You can make a tourniquet out of literally anything, you know what I mean? Any bit of material tied tight can act as a tourniquet.
Right, or like a belt or something like
that? Yeah, or anything like that, yeah. Yeah,
I had an American Marine Special Operations medic on the podcast for a previous episode. They're known as SARCs. That's a Special Amphibious Reconnaissance Corpsman, and basically what he was saying is to control a bleed, if you can find where it's at, you only need like 2 pounds of pressure, and that'll pretty much do the trick. But then I've had people on the podcast who've spoken about incidents where, you know, they've seen like a car crash or something like that, and they were able to pull their car over and you know, get out a tourniquet and place the tourniquet until the EMTs could arrive and get the person to a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something so basic that would really change a lot of lives, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's...
So, Stu, what year was it that you retired from the army? Was that was recently?
Yeah, it was 2012, so 4 years ago.
Okay, and I understand that you've been active since you've retired. I know you still do skydiving and stuff like that.
Well, I gave up the skydiving because I broke my only leg a couple of years doing that, but I certainly enjoyed myself doing that. And I've done numerous things really since I've left. I've done a London Marathon this year, so that was pretty.
Oh wow!
That was pretty hardcore. That was one of the hardest things I've done, definitely.
Oh yeah, and how long is that? That's 26 miles or
26 miles, yeah.
Oh wow! Okay, wow, that's awesome, man.
Mm-hmm.
So is that like you have to do like a lot of training for that?
Yeah, I mean, I've done a couple of walks with another charity, Walking with the Wounded, earlier on in the year, and they were about 20, 22 miles. And I thought, actually, if I could be shoved, I think I could push out another few miles because I was knackered after them. But I thought, if it came to a record, I could push out a few more. And then, so I just put in for the marathon and just kept the top of my fitness and managed to square it away and done it, which I was really, really chuffed with.
Yeah, that's awesome, man.
Cheers.
You know, it's always good to see guys, you know, come back from those type of wounds and still be able to do things. And I think it's very inspirational.
Yeah.
You know, for my audience, there are wounded service members from the States who listen to the podcast. And I think people find that kind of stuff inspiring. So you've done your... You know, you completed your marathons. You've done some skydiving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's awesome, and I want to thank you for taking out the time to come on the podcast. Like we said, I know it's late over there.
No worries, that's cool, John.
Do you have like any like for the charities? Do they have any websites that you know if anyone's interested, maybe in the UK they can check it out?
Yeah, they've got the main one I like is Blesma. That's the British Limbless Serviceman's Association. They basically look after us guys that have been blown up and lost limbs in war zones like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Northern Ireland and such. Yeah, they're a really good charity. And again, there's numerous charities, but Blesma's certainly my top charity that I like.
Okay, cool. So I read. Have you read Battle Worn, Chantel's book?
I have. Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a good book. Actually, I just finished reading it, like maybe a week and a half ago. Yeah. In the book, she mentioned how she, like, towards the end of, I believe it was towards the end of one of her tours, where she had visited you in the hospital.
Yeah, her and her boyfriend at the time, they were just coming off their R&R, and they heard about an incident that was ongoing at Kajaki, but they didn't know anything else about it. And then when Chantel came out of the hospital, she seen me lying there, and she was a bit upset. So and I can't really remember a lot of that about that time anyway, but I remember her popping her head in.
Right, and I know one of the things she spoke about in the book was like how all the other guys were kind of you know, they were sleeping. I believe it was like a medically induced sleep, and you were kind of lying there awake, and she was just talking about how difficult that must have been for you.
I can't really remember these things. I mean, there's because you're that much, because you're that high in drugs after you've just been after I was injured, so it's kind of bit sketchy. But I remember a few things, but certainly I remember Chantel being there, but can't remember a comment about that.
Right. Okay, cool, man. So, you know, I just want to thank you for taking out the time again to come on the podcast. You know, I think my audience, they appreciate being able to hear from, you know, some of our allied nations, warriors. And, you know, I just want to thank you for your service as well.
Thank you. Cheers, John. When's this on your podcasting?
We may release this. I may do it, put it up tomorrow.
All right, cool. Awesome.
So, you know, once it goes up, I'll just shoot you a text.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Cheers, John.
All right, cool, man. Thank you.
Cheers, Richard. Bye.
That was a damn good interview with Stu and, you know, him talking about the stories with his buddies from Three Para over in Afghanistan. I'm glad that most all of them got out, and I'm glad that he's kicking ass now. So,
thanks, Nick, for helping me co-host for this episode. If you want to check out Nick, you can check his website at www.cryptostrategic.com. That's K-R-U-P-T-O strategic.com. It's Crypto Strategic on Instagram and Facebook. Nick posts pretty regularly. If you want to kind of keep up with what he's up to, just check him out there. My website is globalrecon.net. My Facebook is FB Recon. My main Instagram account is IG Recon. I have a secondary account. It's called Black Ops Matter. And just recently, me and Chantel Taylor, who was on the podcast previously, she's a veteran of the British Army. She was a combat medic with rotations to Iraq and Afghanistan. We are collaborating on an account on Instagram. It's called Mission_Critical. And with that account, it'll focus a little more on some of the medical aspects of, you know, military medicine and things like that. So check that out. You can also check out Chantel on Facebook at Battle Worn. And like always, I encourage you guys to subscribe on iTunes, download, share with your friends. If you don't have the Apple operating system, you can find the podcast on SoundCloud. Just search Global Recon Podcast. And we'll see you guys in a couple of days with another episode. Peace.